Who knows who John Glenn is? Ain't got time. John Glenn. John Glenn, first American to orbit the Earth in space. Killed. Was the senator for the state of Ohio. Oldest man to go back up into space because he's a PT god. Before all of that, he was a fucking Marine. An air winger, though. A pilot. Right, Captain Smith? Right. How's that camera? Get the fuck away from me. John Glenn, 1974, ran for Senate against a politician named Howard Metzenbaum. Howard Metzenbaum was a sorry motherfucker. John Glenn, at this point, was a Marine, first American to orbit the Earth in space. Howard Metzenbaum asked him, how can you run for Senate when you never held a job? What the fuck would you do if somebody said that shit to you? Now, I'm going to change a little bit of this. I can. It's my world. John Glenn said, is that right? I served 23 years in the United States Marine Corps. I fought through two wars. I flew 149 missions. My plane was hit by an aircraft fire on 12 different occasions. I was in the space program. It wasn't my job. It was my life that was on the line. And this wasn't a 9-to-5 job where I could take time off and take the daily cash receipts to the bank. I asked you to come with me as I went the other day to a veteran's hospital. And you stand there. You look at those men with their mangled bodies. You look them in the eye and tell them that they never held a job. You come with me and visit any Gold Star mother. You look her in the eye and tell her son never held a job. You come with me to the space program and visit the widows and the orphans of Ed White, Gus Grissom, and Roger Chaykin. And you look those kids in the eye and tell them that their dads never held a job. You come with me on this Memorial Day weekend coming up to Arlington National Cemetery, where I got more friends than I'd like to remember. And you stand there. You watch those waving flags. You think about this nation, and you tell me that those people never held a job. Fuck! I'll tell you, Howard Metzenbaum, you should be on your knee every day of your life thanking God that there are some men who have held a job, and they required a dedication to purpose, a love of country, and a dedication to duty that was more important than life itself. Their self-sacrifice is what made this country fucking possible.
Welcome to the Global Recon Podcast. I'm your host, John Hendricks. I have a special guest on with me for this podcast. His name is Nick Jones. He was a retired Marine Raider and the recipient of the Navy Cross. Nick, how's it going?
I'm good, man. Thank you for having me. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. Having a good day. We've been getting some funky weather here in New York. How are things where you're at weather-wise?
Good. I'm here in Bozeman, Montana, and we've had snow since the mid to late April, and just this last week we had 70s and melted most of the snow at the lower levels. The mountains are still covered, which is actually creates a really cool effect. All the like seasonal springs and creeks are flowing really heavy right now, and grass is getting green. It's a beautiful place to be.
Yeah, I've seen some of your posts on social media. I guess like where you're hiking and stuff like that. It looks amazing out there.
Yeah, it's truly God's country, as they say.
But you're not originally from there, right?
No, I'm originally from Kansas City, just outside Kansas City. I grew up there until I was 18 and joined the Marine Corps. And then I lived in Camp Pendleton over in Southern California for my first 3-ish years of the Marine Corps, and then got stationed out in Camp Lejeune, North Carolina for the next 8 to 9 years. So, found Montana just by fantasizing about it, really, with me and my wife. And we came out here and visited once and just knew, like, as soon as I retire from the military, this is where we're going to set our roots and raise a family. Nice. Came a little sooner than expected, but hey, I can't complain.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I think the closest I've been to over there was on the Canadian side, up in Calgary, like in the like the national park area. I'm forgetting the name of it, like Banff and that whole area.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah, and I guess it's a similar kind of landscape.
Yeah, I haven't been up there yet, but we plan to take a trip up to Glacier, which I think is fairly close to up there. So
that's the national park, right?
Yeah, Glacier National Park. I think it's still in Montana, though, so I don't know the Canadian side. I don't know what the national park is over there.
Yeah, I think it's, if I can recall correctly, I think it borders that part of Canada.
Okay.
But, yeah, okay, so, all right, so let's start with, you know, what motivated you to join the Marine Corps?
Man, so ever since I was a kid, I kind of had an angry side, a rebellious side, a mischievous, if you will, so I rolled with kind of the wrong crowd or the misfits, if you will, in high school and even younger than that. And I had just this kind of aggression about me and liked to fight and get into trouble. And then I guess rewinding from there, when I was in fifth grade, that's when the Twin Towers fell. And then I started watching on YouTube and the news, the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan and things like that. So I was just like, I was always following it. And my sister's friends were old enough to serve, so I would always watch them coming back or about to leave. And I was like, man, this is pretty wild. And then there was a lot of videos coming out from specifically Marines over in Iraq. And I was like, man, like these dudes, this is what I want to do. Like they're crushing shit. They're blowing stuff up. Like that's it. And, so ever since I was a kid, I would be hanging Marine posters all over my wall. And it's really what I wanted to do, but I kept finding myself getting into trouble. And finally I got into trouble again. I ended up, I don't even remember, but ended up going to juvie the day before I had a meeting with my recruiter, and I used my phone call to call my recruiter and say, hey man, I'm not going to make our meeting because I am in juvie right now. And he was like, well, good. Whenever you get out, then I'm coming to your house and we're still doing the meeting. So he showed up at the house and I was, forced to sit down with him, and I talked with him. I was like, look, this is what I want to do, but I just can't stay out of trouble. And he's like, okay, well, we're going to keep you out of trouble. And so he basically, I did all my community service with the Marine recruiting station there and signed a contract as soon as I could. I graduated 6 months early and shipped off to boot camp in January 2010. So, yeah, man, just ever since I was a kid, I always wanted to fight, always wanted to join, and then just felt a calling to serve our nation.
Did you have any family members that served prior to you, or it was just something that you picked up?
So I never knew my grandfather, but I am coming to find out he was in the Army. He was in the Korean War, and I'm still trying to learn more about that, but when I was in the pursuit of joining, I didn't have any family that had served. So it was kind of just felt like it was in my blood that I needed to go to serve. And then learning about that, like just recently, I've been looking more into it. So maybe it was just a calling from him. Who knows?
Yeah, that's awesome. So then what about the, you know, the special operations aspect, did you know that's what you wanted to do before you joined, or did you learn about the Raiders after you joined?
So I learned about the Marine Raiders after I joined, but I always had a desire to go to recon. So being from Kansas City, I actually met a legend named Rudy Reyes when I was out there. He is from the Kansas City area as well.
Oh, he's from Kansas. Yeah.
And so when I was in my whole troubled phase, I was training at this Kung Fu gym. I was doing like mixed martial arts and some Kung Fu to try to ease my anger and channel it a little bit more direct. And then my sensei told me, he's like, hey, there's this legendary Marine coming here. He's filming this show called Generation Kill. I was like, oh my God, I've heard of that. And then he told me who it was. Awesome. I met him and I was like, yes, like this is who I want to be. And got to spar with him a little bit, or I guess he just beat me up quite a bit. And, you know, ever since then, it was just like, this is what I'm doing. I'm going to go recon. And I tried to get a recon contract and they told me I'd have to wait until like October or something like that of 2010. I was like, well, I'm going to get in trouble more if I stay here longer. So let's just go open infantry and I'll just see if I can make it in later. So I went in open infantry contract. I kept trying to volunteer every time a recon selection would come up, and Jones was far enough down the list that I never got picked to go to the selection. So I started out as an 0341 mortarman. And it's funny because that was my very last pick. I did not want to be a mortarman, but Marine Corps has its way of finding what you don't want and giving it to you sometimes. Yeah. So I started out as a mortarman, and then when I went to 2nd Battalion, 5th Marines, I spotted the sniper platoon running around in ghillie suits all the time. And I was like, man, what is this? So we end up going on the 31st MU, and I see these guys running around all the time, getting dirty and carrying heavy shit all the time. So I said, I want to try out for that now. And as soon as we come back off the 31st MU, I take the indoc for the Scout Sniper Platoon. I got selected for that, and then we started working up to go to Afghan in 2012. And it was like during that time when we were doing the workup to go to Afghanistan, we would go to Horno every now and then in Camp Pendleton, and I kept seeing these MARSOC signs all over the place. And I was like, what is MARSOC? So I ended up stopping in their little trailer recruiting station there, and I said, hey, what is this? I checked it out a little bit. They told me about it, and I was like, cool, I want to sign up. And I was a Lance Corporal at the time, had only been in 2 years. And they said, man, you need more time in service, another deployment, or to be an E4. And I was like, okay. So I hit my three-year mark. I went back before we left for Afghan, and I was like, okay, I'm at 3 years. Can I sign up now? They're like, no, you need this other deployment. So we come back from Afghanistan. I try to go put in my package again, and they're like, no, you need to be an E4. And then luckily the next month I picked up corporal, and I went in there and I submitted my package. And that was October of 2012. And in January of 2013, I ended up going to selection and got selected for MARSOC in 2013. So I tried to move as fast as I could to get to where I wanted to go. And once I got selected, I started the individual training course in January of 2014. So I got like several months to heal my body from ANS and, get ready for ITC.
Okay. So, let's go back just a little bit. So two things, can you explain for the audience what a MEW is? And then, did you end up going to sniper school before you went on that deployment, or?
Yeah, sorry, I was jumping around like crazy.
No, that's fine. No problem.
So a MEW, the 31st, it's the Marine Expeditionary Unit. So at the time they called it a MEW. You would basically go, so we flew to Japan. Once we got to Japan, we got on this huge boat. Some of them are aircraft carriers. Others are smaller decks that are just personnel carriers. I was on a larger aircraft carrier called the Essex, but we would basically float around in the Pacific, and we went to all sorts of different areas over there. So we went to Cambodia, Malaysia, Thailand, and we would stop at these different ports, and we would either do training with those local nations, or we would do other amphibious training, because that Marines working with the Navy on their boats, like we would do smaller boat operations or helo operations or things like that. So basically just a maritime response force. Yeah, so after the 31st MEU, went to the Scout Sniper Platoon, and, you know, in order to become a Scout Sniper, you have to go through the INDOC, which is the indoctrination, or it's like a selection course. You get selected, and then they train you up to be what they call a PIG, or a professionally instructed gunman. Once you're a PIG for so long and you kind of prove yourself, then you get the chance to go to the Scout Sniper Basic Course, which is unfortunately no longer a thing. The Marine Corps just got rid of 0317s, the Scout Sniper. But so if you graduate through the basic Scout Sniper course, you're considered a hog, or a hunter of gunmen at this point. And that was my ultimate goal when I was in the sniper platoon. And when I got back from Afghanistan, I had a course to go to actually in January of 2013. And I kind of, you know, I had to choose. I wanted to go to assessment selection for MARSOC, or the Marine Special Operations. And it was a really tough decision, because I really wanted to become a Marine Scout Sniper. But I also knew that at some point, hopefully, I'll be able to go while I'm in MARSOC if I make it. And then there was that thought in the back of my head, well, shit, if I don't make it through the assessment selection for MARSOC, what if I come back to my platoon and now they don't want me to go because I just failed this course and I turned my back on them? So it was weird, like all these doubts in your head going through, and it's just like, well, screw it, man. Like, I want to take the chance and go. So to answer your question, I did not go to Scout Sniper Basic Course before MARSOC. I was fortunate to go to the Marine Special Operations Advanced Sniper Course in 2016. So that was a cool point for me, because I still had that passion for sniping. It's just something about putting on a ghillie suit and sneaking around in the woods, trying to sneak up on your target and, you know, get close and watching him, or take that precision shot. The Marine Special Operations Advanced Sniper Course was a amazing course, and they still have that today, thank God. So it just advances every time. I have a few friends over there as instructors, and it's just amazing what they're doing with that course.
Yeah, I think a couple of years ago, they made like some kind of promo videos showing sections of the course. And it looked really cool. It was like, some of it was like shooting from vehicles or shooting from helicopters, you know, like ghillie suits, and it looked pretty awesome. Something, you know, I don't remember exactly when, it might have been the last few months, but I saw that they've closed the Scout Sniper school, or there's no longer Scout Snipers. Like, can you explain some of that?
You know, I read a little bit into it. I saw the white letter come out, and I wish I could tell you the reasoning why the Marine Corps is going about this. They're saying that Marine Recon and MARSOC are going to have the ability to go to a sniper course. Now, MARSOC has the advanced sniper course, but it doesn't give you an MOS, or a military occupational specialty. It's just kind of another billet that you hold as a sniper. The schoolhouses to become a basic Scout Sniper are no longer. There's like courses that make you a Scout and then a like precision rifleman, but there's no longer the 0317 scout sniper.
That seems strange. Is there like a clear reason why, or?
I couldn't tell you. I think that they explain it in some of their white letters and then in their message, but to me it doesn't make sense. But then again, I'm not a high level official, and I've been out of the game for a little bit, so I couldn't. I don't know. I'm kind of dumbfounded about it.
Okay, yeah, I remember.
And it's really, it's just sad because there's so much tradition behind the Scout Sniper Association. Like, I mean, like I was explaining, the hogs and the pigs and like everything from the selections to graduations to just, I don't know, man, the hog's tooth. There's a lot to it. Like the hog's tooth is a bullet that a lot of snipers wear around their neck. And nowadays you get it when you graduate sniper school. Before, that hog's tooth resembled that back in the day, Chuck Mahaney or Carlos Hathcock, yeah, like doing the sniper on sniper missions. It's like whenever you would kill another sniper, you would stock up and then you would confirm your kill. They would take that bullet out of the chamber of the rifle or the chamber of their enemy's rifle, and they would take that, and that is now their hog's tooth. That round was intended for them, so they wear that in resemblance of they got them first, kill or be killed type thing.
Pretty interesting.
We still carry that tradition. It's pretty wild, but it's sad to see it go.
Yeah, I know a guy who was a scout sniper in the infantry, and then he was an instructor for I think the first iteration or two of MARSOC, a sniper instructor, and he seemed pretty like bummed out about it. And I saw a bunch of Marines just seeming down about that whole situation. Okay, so you go to MARSOC selection in 2013, you said?
Yes.
Okay, can you talk about, your experience there, what that was like?
Yeah, coming from the sniper community, we did a lot of ruck runs. So putting a heavy backpack on, running through the mountains, and getting to selection, it was a lot of the same stuff. It was put a heavy backpack on and run. We did a lot of timed runs. We did a lot of land navigation and some team building exercises. For us, it was 6 weeks long. I think they have like 3 weeks of what they call a prep course. And then the last 3 weeks is the actual selection. And it's pretty tough, man. Like you do a lot of swimming, a lot of running, a lot of rucking. Physical fitness is a huge part of it, and learning how to recover between all of that stuff. You don't have much time, so being prepared is the biggest part, because you can tell the guys who prepared and who didn't, mentally and physically, because they get there and they do the first week and they're already broken. You're going on those long runs and the sun seems like it doesn't want to come up still, because every time you start really, really early and the sun is still down. And then it's like you've been running for hours and the sun still isn't up. And you're like, man, when is this going to come? When is it going to end? And it's like we would always just say, like, you can't stop time. So just keep going, one foot in front of the other. It's wild, the amount of doubt that your mind tries to trick you with. It's like, you could get comfortable. You could go in that van right there. And it's like, not an option. Quitting is not an option. And then it's good that, having that mindset right off the bat helps with everything being in the special operations community, because, you know, I think people would lie to you if they told you that they've never thought about quitting or they've never thought about stopping. Cause I do think that there's a point in everybody's mind that they're like, man, this really sucks right now. Like, I could have a little bit easier ride if I just take a step out and sit in that van. But most of us hear that voice and just kick it away. And you're just like, nah, get the hell out of here, man. I got a job to do. I'm not stopping.
And was that done individually or were you with a group?
Yeah. So I checked into assessment selection with like 144 people. And, by the end of it, I think that there was 46 of us that got selected. So it was pretty wild. After the first 3 weeks, I think we were down to 90. And by the time the end of the 6 weeks, yeah, I think it was either 46 or 44 people got selected, something like that.
So was it just a series of just long rucks and stuff like that?
Yeah. They kind of build you up at the beginning. You do like 4 miles, 8 miles, 10 miles, 12 miles, and then you do a timed 12-mile ruck. And then there's a huge like land navigation course, and it's over several days. So you'll do one day of several points that you have to find in the woods, and then you'll sleep out in the woods, and then you wake up, you check back in, and then you do another full day of that. And it ends with some team building exercises. It's no secret now, like what selection is, but I still don't like to say too much about
sure,
it.
Sure.
Just because like if guys go, like I think it's better to not know all the ins and outs. Cause you know, if you know, you're going to try to game the game and things like that. But it was just a lot of running, and understanding how to do land navigation is going to be key if you do end up finding yourself going to selection, because getting lost in the woods with nobody else around you, because it is an individual effort, but there's a lot of people there, if that makes sense. So you do have to show that you can work well on a team, but you still have to work as an individual. So they do put you in situations where you do team building exercises and you got to make it to point A to point B doing some sort of activity. So you get chances to work in a team, but most of it is individual effort.
Okay. And what's the length of it? Can you talk about that or?
Yeah, it's 6 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then, so then you mentioned before that you passed, and then you waited, was it like a year or a couple of months before you went through the training part of it?
Yep. So I had to wait about 8 months. And I think that was due to like, I had to re-enlist in that time and I had to get things together and move from the West Coast to the East Coast. So I started the individual training course in January of 2014.
Okay. So then, are you able to talk about the training course part of it at all? Like what was it? The individual training course?
Yep. So they call it ITC, or the individual training course. That's 9 months long, and they've done a lot of refining that whole school since I've gone. But back then it was broken down into four different phases. You have your basic tactics phase, which is everything. I guess it was five phases, because there was phase zero and then one through four. Phase zero would be your SEER and medical and communications phase. Then you had a basic tactics phase. You have a shooting phase, which is like CQB, or close quarters combat, and basic rifle range stuff. and then you do reconnaissance phase, so you learn how to take pictures, sneak around in woods again, and then you do a urban or unconventional warfare phase, so learning to live with basically like a guerrilla force and training them up from nothing and learning how to use like very little equipment to kind of build up a force from nothing to an actual self-sustaining fighting force. And then at the end of that, and like, so every phase there's like evaluations, you do peer to peer evaluations. You see like, is this person a good fit? Do they work well with the team? And so like at any point, you know, there's hard gates, you gotta pass all of these qualifications during these phases. And then if your peers don't like you or do like you, they can vote you to stay or to leave. So it's just, it's a, such a high stress situation because you never know. You always want to be on your A game. Like the instructors are still watching you very closely to see, is this guy a good fit for Marine Special Operations? And then your peers are also watching you very closely because it's like, well, if I don't work well with him, these guys must not work well with him. So it's just, you know, you're always trying to be on your A game and do the best you can. Like along with all of these qualifications and different hard gates for ITC, you still have to be extremely physically fit because every phase you do this operational or operator's fitness test. So you have to do another timed 10-mile ruck, a 5-mile run. You do a lot of swimming. Yeah, there's a whole amphibious phase. So, you know, you see people get dropped for a number of things. A lot of it at the beginning is from the pool. Most people, you know, we do a little bit of swimming in the assessment selection, but then when you get to ITC, you do a lot of water work. And water is a humbleizer or equalizer to anybody. And that will get a lot of people. The continuous like physical strain on your body will get to people, and then shooting gets a lot of people. So yeah, it's just wild. There's a lot of different things. And then some people just flat out say like, man, this isn't what I expected. This is either more than I'm willing to chew off, or a lot of it's family oriented. Like you're gone a lot. And that's just the start of it. Like once you make it to the teams, it's a lot more on the family life than most people expect. And then after the,
I was going to say like, just in terms of like being gone and being away a lot of the time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like whenever you're at work, you know, a lot of the times we're there before the sun comes up, and then we're back home when the sun's down again. And it's like when you're working hard. And then when you're back home, you're prepping for the next thing for work. So it's like, I mean, I'm speaking for myself right now and probably for several other operators out there, but it's like every time I was home, I was never actually home. I was always thinking about work. I was always thinking about the next mission or the next training exercise. And I'd like to say that's probably what made us so good at that job, is because we prioritized our job, but then it would hit the family life pretty hard because we'd lose sight on that because we'd be so focused on the mission.
Okay. So you passed the individual training course, and then do you go straight into a platoon? Like, how does that part work?
Yeah, so after I passed ITC, the individual training course, I actually went to 6 months of a basic language course, and I learned modern standard Arabic.
Oh, wow.
Which, yeah, I was And so that was actually a part of our pipeline for several years. I can't speak to if they still have that. I think that they send onesies or twosies to these language courses still. But when I went, there was 6 months of the language course, and it was a full 8-hour day in a classroom from like local, you know, people from Iraq or Jordan or places out in the Middle East. There was a French course and Indonesian as well, I think Tagalog. So we had like a full blown language lab. So that was an interesting part about the job as well. I was not looking forward to that because I absolutely hated school. So learning a new language for me was rough, especially Arabic. It's just a hard language to learn. So yeah, I did that for 6 months. And then while we were in language, we got orders to our battalions. And I was assigned to 2nd Battalion. At the time it was 2nd MSOB, so 2nd Marine Special Operations Battalion, assigned to Hotel Company Team 2. So they, if you get straight into a team, they'll assign you right to a team. If not, they'll send you straight to a battalion, and then you may be in the training cell, like holding at the battalion until a team opens up or gets back from a deployment. But most of the time they'll throw you into a battalion, and then from there, a company and a team.
Okay. All right. Let's rewind a little bit. So before you went to selection and the, I guess the pre-scout sniper course, you went on a combat deployment, right?
Correct. To Afghanistan.
Okay. Can we talk about that deployment a little bit?
Sure.
All right.
Yeah. I was in the Musakala district in 2012. We were at Cobb Shirgazi, like the combat outpost. And I did 7 months total there with 2nd Battalion, 5th Marines. I was in Scout Sniper Platoon, so we would work in really small teams, but we would attach to the line companies. So we did several operations there. I can't speak too much on it because I don't remember a lot. I remember certain firefights and certain like larger missions that we went on. We went on this one large mission for like 17 days, and that was probably the highlight of our deployment there, because we started doing like some offensive stuff and taking over smaller compounds as we would go, pushing the Taliban through certain areas. But being so young, it's kind of funny. Like, I just followed orders. I didn't really know much about the area. I didn't know much about what we were doing. I was just like, you point there, I've got my gun and I'll go. I was mainly the point man though. So I would always carry my metal detector and be sweeping for the team. Found myself in a few sketchy situations, I swept through an entire like old Russian minefield, which was probably the scariest thing I've ever done. It was like Minesweeper, that game on your computer when you like point, like, dude, every 90 degree angle I would make, I'd be like, oh my God, there's another signature, like huge. Jeez. And it was just like, turning around, I was like, just give me some space, because if I step on one of these things, then we're all going. Like, so, I mean, very much on my A game going through there. And it was kind of wild. You know, we would do some missions with the line platoons where we would do these leave behinds. So we would go on these patrols and the line platoon would kind of leave the sniper team and we'd just do overwatch as they're walking. And I do have like memories of those times, like that kind of come back every now and then. There's a time when I was talking to this patrol one time and I told him, hey man, like, I feel like you shouldn't go down this alleyway. I've been watching it all day and everybody keeps avoiding it. Like there's gotta be something there. At the end of the day, it gets hot, dudes get lazy. They end up walking down this exact alleyway that I told them not to walk down. And the third man, 240 gunner, steps on a freaking IED. Luckily the dude didn't die. He just lost both of his legs.
Oh, man.
But that was a rough thing to witness and to like, you know, kind of experience. 'Cause it was like, man, if I was a sergeant, the dude would listen to me. Or maybe if, I don't know. It's those what if situations that kind of screw with you. But yeah, so that deployment was interesting as a young 19-year-old kid. I guess I was 20.
Mm. Okay, so then just for the audience, can you explain exactly what a stay behind is and sort of like what the purpose of doing things that way is?
Yeah. So, you know, you go out as a larger footprint. So like a larger patrol, and this way, like, let's just say the Taliban is watching you and they try to count your numbers. They may get it mixed up. What have you. So you go out as a large patrol, you stop in this one section, and then two or three of us will stay behind and we will make a hide. So like a little area that we can watch over the patrol. We can watch certain avenues of approach. And the patrol will leave and they'll go out and it'll look just like they were before. And this gives us the opportunity for the enemy to not understand that there's still people that are in the same holding pattern, in watching over them. So if they do take contact, then we have the ability to provide precision fires on those select targets, or, you know, we can have a collection casualty point already established for them, or there's all sorts of different things. Or if they leave, we can do a remain overnight and just continue to collect information on that area and continue to develop the situation further. So those are super beneficial for certain areas. And they've actually came in handy before. You know, we've done several and actually caught a lot of bad dudes coming in on mopeds or on their ICOM. So like their communication, we'll intercept them, take precision shots. We have helped out several patrols where we took precision shots on some spotters that actually helped in mitigating an ambush. So our team, I think we saw some spotters at like 900 yards away watching this patrol moving around, and we were set up on the top of this mud hut one time. Spotted these guys with these walkie-talkies, and they were talking, pointing, and I was like, those dudes are definitely bad. And we got cleared hot to take shots on them, and I think we put down several of them, and they ended up kicking off an ambush shortly after that, but it was way less effective due to the precision fires that we just were able to deliver. So, yeah, it's got its huge benefits doing those remain over or leave behind missions.
Yeah. Okay. And how long was this deployment?
It was about 7 months. Yeah.
And was this southern Afghanistan?
Yes. Down in Helmand province.
Okay. Okay. All right, so you know that was your first experience in combat. So let's sort of fast forward a little bit. Was your first deployment with MARSOC back to Afghanistan?
No, it was back to Iraq, or I guess not back to Iraq. It was to Iraq for my first time. I was in northern Iraq up in like the Kurdistan district. And this was in 2016 when ISIS was like pretty hot and heavy up there. They kind of did their first initial push and appearance to the world in 2014. But 2016 and 2017 was like a pretty gnarly battles up there in northern Iraq.
So all of your MARSOC experience is basically countering ISIS in Iraq?
Yes.
Okay. You know, was there major differences from your experience in Afghanistan in the Marine infantry to your experience in Iraq and the Marine Special Operations?
Oh, yeah. It was, you know, I mean, I was used to working in smaller teams, and being in MARSOC, we would deploy with only like upwards of 20 people in our team. So it was a very small footprint for like the areas that we were in. Like we had the large company out there, but we would break off into our smaller team houses and we would have a lot more freedom of movement. In my first deployment in Iraq in 2016, you know, we did a lot of a lot more recon, a lot more like flying the ISR birds, so like the basically this little spy planes up there. We would be watching, looking over these towns where ISIS was. And it's funny because whenever I joined, I told you I did not want to be a mortarman. Well, going to MARSOC and working in these small teams, being a mortarman was actually like one of the most beneficial skills that I could have brought to that team. Because when we went to Iraq, all of our engagements were really far away. And by the time that we would get cleared to engage, we would really only be able to hit them with mortars. And we had an 81 millimeter mortar, we had a 60 millimeter mortar, and then we ended up getting a 120 millimeter mortar. And boy, did that thing rock. I think I've never been so much more proud of like a skill that I had than being a mortarman then, because it was like we put that thing to work. I mean, I had mortar holes, mortar pits that I was standing in. The mortar tube like starts out higher than me as a 120 millimeter mortar, and then by the time it was done, like I'm like sinking this thing so far into the ground, we had to use snatch ropes and winches to pull it out. Wow. Because yeah, we had, I think there was a day that we shot over 150 120 millimeter mortars. And we wrecked ISIS, destroyed villages. It was wild. And that 120 millimeter mortar, man, that thing will do some damage. You set it to proximity burst, which blows up like 3 to 5 meters above the ground, and it'll spread like 75 meters wide.
Oh, wow.
Like that's an entire football field of people you can injure.
Oh, shit.
Or kill. Yeah. There's one specific mission where I don't know how many war stories you want me to tell, but
no, that's fine.
There's one specific mission where like the Kurdish were doing this offensive push into this village, and ISIS was getting so overwhelmed that they were retreating, and their only way out of this village was down this like 5 mile long straight road. And I was like, that is perfect. It's already a target reference point for me. So it was super easy for me to get my mortar right up on it. And I just did a search mission, basically just messing with my elevation bar. And I would drop around, hit my elevation bar. So it would basically just walk this road and just killing ISIS dudes along the way. It was probably the most satisfying mission I've done, especially when they brought a trailer full of dead ISIS fighters stacked up on this thing, like a huge semi-flatbed trailer. It was pretty wild. I wouldn't say that all of those were from me. They did a lot of bomb dropping, and the Kurdish fighters went in there and killed a lot of dudes as well. But yeah, it was a really cool skill to have on that deployment.
And was that your experience for all of your MARSOC deployments, where you guys are, you know, fighting mostly from a distance and like utilizing mortars and air and stuff like that? Experts say that China is hoarding a massive amount of food. They will soon have over 2/3 of the globe's corn reserves and over half of its rice and over half of its wheat. But when asked about it, China lies. One China expert says that they, of course, will never admit to something like that. Well, what does China know that we don't? When it comes to global food shortages, China is the canary in the coal mine. You see, China is the world's number one importer of food. They rely on the rest of the world to keep their people fed. So they can't afford to mess up, or there will be riots, civil panic, or even worse, over 1 billion people won't have food to eat. What does this mean for Americans like you and me? Two words, food shortages. That's why it's a smart idea to stock up on a kit of the best-selling Four Patriots survival food. Create your own stockpile of the best-selling Four Patriots survival food kits. It's hand-picked in the USA. The kits are compact and they stack easily. They have different delicious breakfasts, lunches, and dinners. And their 5-star reviews on the website rave about the flavor and taste. Right now, you can get 10% off your first purchase of Four Patriot Survival Food by typing in the code RECON at checkout. Just go to fourpatriots.com and use RECON to get 10% off your first purchase of Four Patriot Survival Food. That's fourpatriots.com. Use the code RECON.
No. So that I think deployment was an anomaly. And I think that kind of like kicked off a bigger offensive, because subsequent deployments to ours, the guys went into Mosul and they went into other cities and they started like really fighting closer quarters. My second deployment with MARSOC was to Jordan. And so I got kind of a break from combat there. And then in 2020, I got orders to go back to northern Iraq, and we were going to be up in the Mosul district area. And this was a totally different dynamic deployment. ISIS was kind of back down to their insurgency level, so they were hiding out more, using sleeper cells, like smaller little pockets of fighters everywhere. And we found out that they were mainly hiding out in like tunnels and caves. So we went from fighting in huge open areas and in towns to now very confined, tight spaces, subterranean warfare type stuff. So having to learn a completely new tactic. So I hung out with my EOD techs, our explosive ordnance disposal guys, a lot, and learned how to make a lot of explosives and satchel charges. So like lots of C4 thrown in tunnels and caves, trying to blow these dudes up or blow bigger holes to get in there easier. It was very, very interesting dynamic getting on that last deployment, 2020.
So that's basically like a counterinsurgency kind of focus, like, you know, looking for these different cells and targeting them, or?
Yeah, our main focus was at that point was to try to, like, we were at the point where we were trying to hand it back over to our Iraqi counterparts. Like, the ISIS fighters are in a state where they're hiding more. They're, you know, they're not doing much of offensive attacks. So it's our chance to like take a step back, make sure that our partner force can still fight. So before, like, you know, we would send them in there and we'd kind of take a terrain feature away and monitor them and make sure that they're doing okay. Well, you know, that would only work for so long. They would complete their mission and then we would go in and either find another bad guy or find something else that they might have missed. So then it would be another fight for the Americans. And then there was larger missions that, like the one I got wounded on, it was actually like we had been watching this particular cave complex for weeks, and then they started to get information that there was higher value targets that may be there, or, you know, this was going to be a bigger mission than just sending in the partner force. So that's when we were tasked to get ready and do this with them. But yeah, it was different. Sometimes we would just have to send them in. Sometimes we would be able to go with them. This particular one, we were able to go with them.
Okay. And was it on this deployment where the incident took place that you were awarded the Navy Cross for?
Yes.
Okay. Can we talk about that situation?
Yeah. So, like I kind of just mentioned, we had been watching this huge cave complex for weeks. There was intel that there was several different cave entrances, and there was a total of about 7 fighters that they had seen coming in and out of these caves. So my team got the order that, you know, we're going to go do a battle damage assessment after we kind of drop a bunch of bombs on this thing. We're going to go see what we can kind of stir up and see what's left over. So anyways, we get tasked with this, and there's about 20 of us and 50 or so of our Iraqi partner force that are doing rehearsals and training to go out here on this mission. And it was about 24 hours before we are going to insert. We do our final rehearsals, do our final talk-throughs, and then we start continuing to watch this cave, and a couple more fighters start showing up. And then now I think numbers are like at 11 fighters. Now we have some ground forces that just inserted. There's actually snipers that got in before us. They were watching, like, hey, there's more people showing up. It's about 12 hours before we're going to insert. Now there's like 12 or 13. And then 2 hours or so before we leave, there's like 19 fighters now. And it's like, whoa, you think they might know that we're coming, huh? So my team was actually filled with, I would say 80% of the guys had never seen combat. And so when they're seeing this and they're seeing this on, you know, the intel updates, everyone started getting excited. They're like, oh yeah, like we're finally going to see combat. We're finally going to get in a firefight. And I was a more senior guy on the team at that time. So I bring my guys in and I was like, look, like I know everybody's excited here, but like, just, you got to take a step back and like, you got to look at it. Like, we are ready for this. We're trained for this. But once the bullets start flying, like, it's real. So I'm not doing this to scare you. I'm doing this to make sure that you're prepared. Like, we will see a fight. You need to be on your A game. Like, we know what to do. So just be ready and don't get too fucking wrapped around the fact that all you want to do is fight. Like, still take your time. Don't go looking for it. And so, you know, we still got the word that we're going in, even though the reinforcements had over doubled in size since we started first watching it. So we insert in the middle of the day. I guess it was early morning, so the sun was already high, which is one of the another mistake. So we insert in and we get up there and start walking down towards the cave complexes. And at this time there had been, I don't know, maybe 10,000 pounds of bombs dropped on this cave complex already, hitting every single entrance. So there was like seven different entrances. There was a couple 2,000 pounder bombs that went off. Snipers had engaged some bad dudes, so they had already softened this place up for us, and it was nice and quiet when we got there. It was actually pretty surreal flying there because you could see like the mushroom clouds coming up as we were getting closer, and you know, it was a pretty wild wild ride on the way there. So anyways, we get there and we're walking down closer to these entrances, and you can see the rubble and you can start seeing dead bodies and body parts and things like that all over the place. And we get into this first cave, and I'm talking with the team chief on the radio, and he sees another section that he wants to go check out. And originally the whole fighting force was supposed to stay together, and he wanted to go check out this certain section. So he broke off and took a few guys and several Iraqis down to a different cave, and they started looking at that while we are processing one cave. One thing leads to another. We start searching another cave complex, because basically the way that we were doing it is going to enter into a cave, clear it out as we go. That way we don't miss anything and miss any hidey holes or anything like that. So now that the force is split up, I can't see them. They can't see me. It was an eerie feeling, but at this time there's no more contact being taken. I'm currently staring at in the face of this dead ISIS fighter about to enter into this cave. He's covered in dust. Like I can see this face burned into my memory forever. And it was at this moment I'm looking at this guy, and then like hell breaks loose behind me. Radio calls start coming in. We're taking contact 30 meters away, 20 meters, 5 meters. And then it was fast. Explosions, automatic machine guns, like everything just opening up. And in the mountains, like it exacerbates everything, so it just sounds that much more intense. It was very, very intense. But I was like, okay, I mean, normal firefight, they've got it. I start to kind of move forward, and then I hear that there's a casualty over the radio. And then I'm like, okay, it's fine. It's a partner force from the radio call. Like, not that that's okay, but I just knew that they got it. They've got it under control. They're operators. They know what to do. But then not even a second later, there's an eagle down. And like that call over the radio was the most heart wrenching, like gut dropping call I've ever heard. And I was like, oh shit.
So just quickly for the audience, the eagle down indicates that an American is down.
Correct. Yeah. Yep. So hearing that, like, you know, it makes me immediately want to turn and go, but I knew, you know, they've got this, they've got it under control. And then not even a second later, there's another eagle down. And I was like, oh my God. And at that point, like, I turned to my partner force that were standing right there. I said, you guys, you watch this cave, search it, do what you need to do, but I got to go. And I ran in the most untactical manner I could over this finger and down. And I passed a couple different cave entrances on my way. And whatever I could see, I did a little drive-by shooting in there. I shot a couple times, shooting at these blankets, what have you, just in case it was a bad dude. But then I make my way and I find the chaos. There's still gunfire going off. There's still a huge battle going on. I ask everybody in the area, like, where are the casualties? What's going on? What's happening? And there's a couple French operators down there, a couple Iraqi partner forces. And there's a one U.S. guy that I couldn't talk to at that point, but Nobody was saying anything. So it's like, what the hell is going on? And I hear gunfire coming in this ravine. So I threw my ruck off and I just jump in this ravine. And there's one dude in there. And this one dude happened to be a French operator, and he was in the middle of fighting. There were some bullets coming at us, and I say, "Hey, dude, where are the casualties at?" And basically, just by his posture and the way that his gun was pointing, I was like, "Okay, well, there's the fight is right here. Let me just help him out here." So I start crawling up on these rocks, and then I poke my head up, and now I see the entrance, the mouth of this cave. Fortified bunker, fucking rocks stacked up like crazy. But as soon as I see that, they see me, and just machine gun fire just rips up over my head. And I was like, oh shit. So I get down, and it's funny, as I'm talking, I'm like ducking like it's happening again. So at that moment, when I saw the cave, I also saw a body right there. And my first initial instinct is like, that dude's definitely dead for how much fire is going on right here. But this French guy keeps yelling at him, and he keeps saying something in French. And later I found out that he was telling him to roll. He was saying, roll, roll. And he kept saying this. And then next thing you know, I see these legs fly up in the air. And natural instinct kicks in. I chicken wing my gun. So I put my gun, my buttstock underneath my shoulder, and run up there as fast as I could, shooting with one hand. And I grab this dude with my other hand, and I start pulling him down these rocks. I fucking throw him as hard as I could, shooting on my way back. And then this other French operator, he's shooting as well. And like, once I get him to a certain spot, like hands come out of nowhere and they start grabbing him and throwing him down. And, this guy, he was a French operator, and he had been shot in the through and through in the leg, couldn't walk, and then shot in the top of the head, went through his helmet and like skimmed, gave him a haircut on the top of his head. So helmets work. So he was alive, and we got him out of there, and I stayed and I was fighting, trying to help for these guys to get out. And then now at this point, there was another American that came up, and he was yelling at me. He's like, "Hey, like, what do you need?" He's about to jump down in there with me. I was like, "Do not come in here." He's like, "Throw some smoke or throw some frags or something. Like, get me out of this thing though, because if anybody comes down here, we're dead." And so finally somebody pops a smoke. I get a chance to get out of there. And, like these walls, man, they were close. So it was probably like a meter and a half wide. So, probably I would say 7 feet. No, it might've been 10 feet. But it was still very, very close quarters, and this huge cave entrance just staring me in the face the whole time. It was a very intense moment. But once they popped the smoke, I got out and I basically crawled up and met up with another American. And I said, "Hey man, like, where are the casualties at?" I didn't see him down there. He said, he wasn't sure. The last time he saw him, they were here, and now he turned around and they were gone. And so I said, "Okay." I talked to the snipers that were in this position. I said, "Walk me on to where you think these guys are." And I start crawling, creeping up as slow as I could. Now I'm on top of the roof of the cave. The way they like burrowed into the bottom of this ravine. It was just, it's hard to envision without seeing this, gnarly cave complex. But I'm basically on top of their roof now, and these snipers are walking me in. And as I'm getting closer and closer, I can see more and more of this ravine. And then that's when I see them. I see the first body laying there. And I could immediately tell just by looking that this guy, he was gone. And I go a little bit closer, creep up a little bit more. And then next thing you know, I see the next one. And he looked a little bit more alive. His eyes were still open and he was sitting up, he was still holding his gun, but it was like he was in a position where he was like trying to push back and push away. And this is, you know, I kind of tell, but I decided to call out his name, and I said, "Hey, Mo." I tried to be as quiet as I could because I didn't want them to know that I was up there. And I said his name a couple times and no response. And that's when I knew that they were both gone. So I went back and I radioed up to the commander and I said, "Hey, sir, Mo and Diego are gone." And that's when, like, there was silence. I mean, we all knew, but the commander wanted another confirmation. I was like, "Look, man, like, I don't know how much more clearly I need to tell you this, but Mo and Diego are dead." And it was just such a hard thing to believe because, like, one, like, Mo was the executive officer for the company. So he was a captain at the time. He was posthumously awarded or promoted to major. And then our team chief, who was a gunnery sergeant. So two very high-ranking individuals out there that shouldn't – I mean, I don't know. They were found in the wrong place at the wrong time. And it was just so hard for most of the assault force to kind of come to grasp with right off the bat. But it was like, we don't have time to really – sit here and do this right now. Like, they're gone. Let's come up with a plan. We got to get them out of here. So, like, it no longer became this cave clearance operation. It was now a recovery mission. So I did everything I could up there and had the snipers engaged, like, very, and like, whenever I say, like, I have a huge, huge respect for the Marine Special Operations Advanced Sniper Course, like, this day solidifies their training. Like, they were shooting very, very close to me. I mean, within feet. And they were engaging very small targets through very small holes, trying to kill these guys as I was going up and chucking grenades inside of this cave. And every time I'd go up there, I'd be getting littered with gunfire. And I'd end up having to pull out. I did this for hours, and then at one point, you know, we shot a Carl G in there, or at least tried, and then I tried to call in the Apaches. The Apaches shot about 220 of their 30mm cannon at it, and there was little to no effect. And then I called in a Hellfire, and they needed a 10-digit grid. So I said, "Okay, like, I will get you a 10-digit grid." I walked up and I stood on the top of their cave. I was like, "Do you see me? This is your grid." And I probably didn't do some of the smartest things that day, but, you know, I gave them what they needed. They threaded a Hellfire in there, and there was still, like, little to no effect. Like, what we needed was a little bit of fucking, like, lull in this gunfire, but every time we would go up, they would still be there, still shooting at us. And it's like, there's got to be other fighting positions somewhere. Like, how are they still alive? And we keep regrouping, trying to make these new plans. And I go back in for the last time, and I chuck a couple more grenades. And then next thing you know, like, I feel like I got hit by a baseball bat in my right leg. And I was like, "Holy shit, what was that?" And, I get down, I get back away from the top of the cave, and I look down at my leg, and there wasn't too much blood coming out, but I went over to the medic and I was like, "Man, I think I just got shot." And he's like, "What do you mean you think you got shot?" I was like, "I just felt a really gnarly pain come in through my leg." And he cuts up in my pants and looks at it, and it's like, "Yeah, there's definitely something there." And it was just a little pinprick, and my leg was already swollen and blood's trickling out. And I was like, "Shit." Could hardly put any pressure on it, but at this point it was like, I'm not calling in a medevac right now. I'm not telling the captain. I'm not doing any of that. We have a mission to do. And I tried to, like, walk on it, and I was like, "No." So at this point I call up to the commander. I say, "Hey, man, like, we got to pull back a little bit, wait for the QRF to get here, the quick reaction force." So, like, the guys were on call. They were coming for that whole time, but it was just in a really crappy location, so it took them a while to get there. So told the commander, we're going to push up on top of this finger and wait for the QRF to get there. And little did I know, they could see me limping from up there on the top of the hill. The medics had called in a little bit and said, hey, we got another guy wounded. And they were going to put me on a stretcher and carry me up. And I said, no, like, we've got too much stuff going on, man. Like, I'm going to try to walk. So they just made like a diamond around me and protected me as I walked back up this mountain and still tried to stay in control, stay in command, and refused medical attention for a while. And until the pain got so bad, I was just like, dude, all right, give me the lollipop. They had like fentanyl lollipops. And by the time we got up to the top of this like finger, they had called in a 9-line for me, and the medevac bird had came down and hoisted me out. But later that night is when the quick reaction force or another unit, Delta Force unit, came in and was able to recover our guys. They had actually a pretty gnarly fight going in as well. They killed four more ISIS fighters, a suicide vest cranked off inside of there that wounded, not severely, just mildly wounded two operators that were there that night. But all in all, they did recover our guys. They did bring them home that night. But that was, you know, to me, leaving that battlefield that day, I felt like a failure because I had tried so hard. I had planned so much. Like, I should have been the one to bring them home that day, and I failed. And that ate me up for so long. But it was also reassuring because I knew they were home. I knew that they were recovered and they were back with the, you know, the force. They were going home. Yeah, man, that was so I got awarded the Purple Heart later that week. And then it was August 26th of 2021 was when my Navy Cross was approved and awarded to me by the Secretary of the Navy. And that was actually the same day of the attack in Afghanistan that killed 13 Marines. So it was a very surreal day being called directly by the Secretary of the Navy, by him telling me like, hey man, I don't think that I'm going to make it because there was just a bombing in Afghanistan that killed 13 Marines.
At the airport, you mean?
Yeah. Mm. Yep. And so I was, you know, I understood. And then he called me back. He's like, look, I'm coming. We're getting on the bird. We're flying down there and we're going to award you this Navy Cross because he's like, you know, this stuff doesn't happen all the time. And, you know, where there's life, there's death, and where there's death, there's life. So we need to be able to recognize both. And it was actually a pretty surreal moment when he came and gave his speech. And we all kind of took a moment for those Marines as well. So yeah, it was just a crazy sequence of events that had unfolded, from all of that. And the injuries that I sustained after or during that mission, you know, I'm still dealing with the pain and the residual effects from it. I've had 8 major surgeries. I still have my leg. I still have use of my leg, but I have several nerve chunks amputated out of my leg. So like I have constant nerve, like some weird pain sensations and tinglies. I couldn't wear boots for almost 2 years. I had this spinal cord stimulator installed in my back that had these wires running through my spine to control my pain in my leg. But just in July of 2022, I got that stimulator removed and I got another nerve amputated out of my leg. That surgery right there has like changed my quality of life entirely. I can do what I want. Like I can run, I can ruck again. I just competed in a boxing match and actually won.
Oh, like, nice.
I'm not letting it stop me now. I'm getting back to my old ways, getting physically fit, staying mentally sharp. I run a foundation now that I started right after I got shot, called Talon's Reach Foundation. So yeah, man, that day will never leave my mind and my heart. That was my dog. It sounds like a saw. He's a pit bull that always flaps his ears like that every time he stands up. So sorry about that.
That's all right.
But yeah, man, like that injury, I thought I was never going to walk normally again. I thought that I wasn't going to be normal again, because it, like, my physical wounds, you know, they were there, but my mental wounds, they were so much more intense than I was ever expecting. Cause I didn't think PTSD was going to be the one that, you know, gets me. And for years, it definitely came to bite me in the ass. And I mean, I'm not perfect now. I still struggle. I still have mental struggles every day. And, I guess the difference is I finally do something about it, and I finally take care of myself to be able to combat those when they do come. I've been sober from alcohol for 10 months.
Nice.
And that's been like the most life-changing decision I've made. Because as much as we want to believe that alcohol helps us remember and helps us forget and helps us ease pain, it does none of that. It makes it worse, at least for me. And you know, it damn near made me take my own life. So, you know, that's not who I want to be, and that's not how I want my legacy to end. And, I have a family now. I have a daughter, 8 months old, and a wife that loves me, and a family that loves me, and a community that, you know, would still kill for me. And to think that I was alone in my struggles after that mission, that so badly I wanted to end my own life, like, it was the waking point of my life, that made me realize that there's more. So, you know, we make it through so much on the battlefield. We make it through so much in all of these trainings that, like, we deserve to live. We deserve happiness. We deserve to feel free. And the last thing that we should feel is alone. And, you know, like, you're doing something like this to help spread messages. You're doing like these podcasts, these messages that people send, like, it's all the same community reaching out, telling one another their stories and their ways that they get by. And, you know, we can all learn something from each other and being there for each other and showing each other that we're not alone. Those buddy checks, as small as they sound, they're super important.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So do you do anything, cause I know you go on like hikes and stuff like that. And, but do you do anything else for like stress management?
Yeah. So I do, yoga was a huge part of my life. I did a lot of yoga. The last surgery that I had, I think kind of messed up, that opportunity for me. I can't stretch my leg the way that I used to, but I do different, I guess, adaptive yoga. I'm actually getting certified as a breathwork facilitator right now.
Nice.
I'm almost done with my certificate for that. So breathwork has been a huge, impact to my life, yeah, to my family's life. Like, that is one of those, I can enter into like a whole nother world and time.
It's a game changer for sure.
Yes, absolutely. So that and meditation, they're huge for me. One of the weird modalities that I really like is art. I thought that I would never paint or draw, but whenever I dabbled into art therapy, that was like one of the most like expressive, like, I started bawling my eyes out when I first started it. And yeah, it, like, I don't even know why. But now, like, it's one of those things, like, it's just such a calming thing for me that I absolutely love it. Music is another one. I don't play an instrument, but I listen to music and I like associate it with times and places. And, you know, I can just, it's kind of like a meditation for me almost.
Yeah.
And then getting outdoors, man, anything, like learning how to truly live in the present instead of getting out there and like thinking about what happened. It's like, I get out there and I live for the now. Like I look at rocks, I look at algae and mold and weird shit growing on rocks. I look at trees. Like I truly try to live here and now. Like, and what's amazing about that is I actually have time for my family. I have time to look at my daughter and watch her smile and grow and be there with my dogs. And it's just crazy how fast we lived, like the fast paced life, never slowing down. Like I spent so much time in the woods and in the mountains before, but I've never seen the amount of colors and the amount of like mushrooms and weird shit that grows out there until now. Like I finally slow down and I take these hikes and I look around and I'm like, holy crap. Like there are what seems like hundreds of colors and different flowers and things. And like, we just never take that time to just sit there, breathe and feel real, feel alive. Like we have so much to offer and we have so much to see and experience, but a lot of the times we don't take that time for ourselves because we're always rushing to that next thing. So that like has been one of my huge learning points to my like recovery is being present.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that is what is true happiness.
Yeah. And it's one of the tenets of meditation, right? To be present, to not be, you know, not have your mind thinking about the future or the past, just to be where you're at now and exist in that moment. And it's really fascinating stuff. I only started breathwork and meditation during the pandemic. But I was just blown away by how effective it is. And it's great for stress management. You know, it's also great for like increasing your blood oxygen levels and so many different benefits. It's really amazing. But it's, you know, it's a lot of it comes from like Eastern philosophy, Eastern practice, you know, Buddhism and things like that. But you know, a thing that's interesting is there's certain periods in history that I've been fascinated by, and I've been to Japan before, and I've read a ton of books, you know, by Japanese philosophers and samurai and things like that. And one of the things they speak about is for warriors in particular, like when you're no longer fighting a war, to have different things that you do, like art. Like they were big on like tea ceremonies and like painting, and they have these things called rock gardens, which requires like a high level of maintenance and it looks really nice. So like all of these things that you're mentioning are things that warriors in the past did in their sort of non-warrior life, you know what I mean? Like not being in combat anymore, and they're finding these different things to do that keep your brain active. And you know, the way you speak about noticing, you know, things on your hikes that you didn't notice before, you know, that's also important in being aware and present in the moment. So it's all good stuff.
Yeah. It is definitely, it's intriguing. Slowing down, but like the amount of detail and attention it takes. Like we have chickens now, we have 12 chickens. We try to raise a garden, which is probably one of the hardest things I've ever done. Yeah. Especially in Montana, like waiting for the freeze to, like, you got to wait for a specific time. And then you got to make sure that there's just so much that goes into it, but it's like that time and focus that it takes is time that you are giving to yourself and your mind to to relax and like fully be there and be aware. Like you were saying, it's just, you know, most of us want to get out and we want to go stay at 100 miles an hour and go back into like a shooting lifestyle or go back into the combat sports or something like that. It's like, I still like find it so important to be able to take care of my mind, body, and spirit in conjunction with that. If I would have known these tools while I was in, I feel like I would have been at a whole nother level of operator, like learning how to be able to slow down and really focus on these things. Like I think would have really increased my operational skills too.
Yeah, right. Because it's like you're enhancing your brain and your focus. You know, especially like when you're doing the breath work, you know, there are different, I'm sure you're aware, there are different breathing techniques for different end states, right? Like you can breathe
right
to get energy. You can breathe to go to sleep. You can breathe to increase your lung capacity, right? Like there's so many different things that you can do. And I typically... Like I'll have weeks where I do like three or four different breath exercises per day, and then I'll go a couple of days without doing anything. But when I'm on top of it, I'll do a breathing exercise in the morning before I get out of bed, and that sort of energizes me. And that's usually a quicker session, and then I'll do different ones to increase my lung capacity. Which usually entails like, you know, an inhale, a hold, an exhale, and then a longer hold.
Yeah.
And then like I'll do something at night when I'm winding down and getting ready to go to bed. And those are usually a bit longer, like 5 minutes or 6 minutes or so. But yeah, it just focuses your mind. It's really amazing stuff. And I would say mindfulness, the breathing exercises and the meditation, if there's one thing I can say I wish I picked up earlier in life, it's definitely that.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Okay, so let's talk about the foundation.
Yeah. So Talon's Reach Foundation, I started it after or during my basic recovery. So I started going to this clinic called the Intrepid Spirit Clinic. It's for traumatic brain injury. They had like this multi-dimensional or multifunctional team that looked at you from all sorts of different angles. They introduced you to occupational therapy, physical therapy. They had psychiatrists, psychologists, all the traditional types of medicine there. But then they also had all of these non-traditional stuff that they would mix in with it, like art therapy, music therapy, yoga, this eye rest thing. So kind of dabbling in all that. And, you know, I tried talk therapy and I tried taking medicine. I tried doing all of that stuff. And what was most beneficial for me was just like what we were talking about, was the meditation, the mindfulness stuff, the breathing, the yoga, the art. And, you know, so that having such a profound, you know, experience for me during my recovery, I was talking with a buddy and I was like, man, like I'm moving out to Montana. I want to stay connected with the community somehow. Like, I don't know what to do though. Like, I don't know what I'm good at. I want to start a foundation. I want to do something, maybe take dudes on hunts and bring people out into the outdoors. Well, didn't know if I'd be able to walk again. So that kind of went out the window. And then I got the chance to share my story in front of a bunch of random people. A few special operators were out in the audience as well. And it was the first time I publicly shared my story. And when I did it, it really did something for me. It, like had such an amazing impact on myself and the audience that some of those operators came up to me and they're like, dude, I've never wanted to talk about my story until you just mentioned all of this stuff. And then they would just open up and vent to me. And like, they're like, wow, like I feel so much better from that. And then it clicked. I was like, that's what I'm doing. Like, I'm going to start this foundation. I'm going to introduce them to all of these different modalities to healing. We're going to educate them on different signs and symptoms. So we educate on operator syndrome, traumatic brain injury, PTSD, all sorts of different stuff that comes up. We have other classes along the way too. And basically like how to change your mind from being in a slump to, you know, reversing everything to being able to see the positive, and kind of keeping it a little vague with that stuff in my description right now. But so we do a lot of education. We do a lot of group discussions, kind of tailored towards whatever needs to be talked about. We give them an opportunity to share, safe space to share. And then we do a lot of recreational activities as well. So we get out into the outdoors and kind of do like this ebb and flow of emotions, if you will. It's like we ramp them up, get into this sympathetic state of your nervous system. It's like, man, like they're in overdrive thinking like, shit, I have all this stuff wrong with me. What am I ever going to do about it? And then we take them out into the outdoors and you see like them completely level out and just relax and sink into it. And they're just like, wow, okay, like this is what being present is. This is what like being in touch with my roots is, like getting out and fly fishing or exploring on side by sides, or this last program we did ice fishing and snowmobiling. So we'll, you know, get them back into that parasympathetic state and get them outdoors to relax and really decompress, bring them back, introduce yoga, introduce music, introduce art therapy, and really just, you know, give them a huge wide variety of tools to be able to use in times like this, whenever things are getting hard. It's like, okay, well, what coping mechanisms can I do that are healthy, rather than what coping mechanisms can I do to destroy my life more? So, we started with the idea of doing 5-day long programs out here in Montana, and we've stuck with it, man. We've done 3 successful programs so far. We have our 4th one coming up in October of this year. And we plan to continue to grow. We plan to do 4 programs next year in 2024. And with the goal of having our own property out here one day in Montana, being able to crank these things out and helping more operators as we go along.
That's phenomenal stuff. And all of it, like all this, these activities of like going out and stuff, that's all in Montana?
Yes, for now.
Okay. And
yeah, we've had ideas of branching out and things like that. Right now we don't have the team or the support to do that yet. But who knows, eventually we might have some chapters open up, but this is going to be the hub. This is a very amazing healing grounds out here.
Yeah. I mean, you know, just looking at some of your posts from when you're going hiking and stuff, I mean, it looks like a phenomenal place, Montana. And I'm also a photographer. So, like, I've been all around the world and I've done like the, you know, like go on a beach kind of and just chill out vacations. But that's really not my thing. Like, I prefer going to like some cool, unique sort of landscape type place and just exploring. So, you know, when I see that kind of thing, it just looks like amazing, an amazing place to be. Yeah, so that's all phenomenal stuff. And so if anyone is interested in, like, checking out the foundation or anything like that, where can they go to do that?
So we have a website. It's www.talonsreachfoundation.org. There's a short little promo video on there that explains some more of our story. There's a lot more information on there about the programs, ways to donate, ways to submit an application to become a participant. We actually call our participants Eagles. And then there's volunteer applications on there as well. If you'd like to volunteer, we have social media, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. I think we have a Twitter, but I've never used it before. So there's that. Yeah. And then my email, it's just nick@talonsreachfoundation.org. There's all sorts of different ways to get involved. You know, a lot of it is just sharing the story and getting the word out there so we can help as many people as we can.
Yeah. Okay. So Nick, it was amazing to do this today. I know we were kind of going back and forth for a while now, but, I'm glad that we got to do this, and I'm also glad that you're actively taking steps to, you know, manage stress and deal with your, the mental battle and the physical as well. So that's really good stuff, man.
Yeah. Thank you, John. Thanks for having me on. And I really appreciate you taking the time to allow me to share my story.
Yeah. I mean, maybe we can have you back on someday. This is great. And I think the audience is going to appreciate hearing your story. And I think, you know, most importantly for guys who are in similar situations, combat vets, to be able to utilize some of the tools that you spoke about, I think is golden and invaluable. So I appreciate you coming on here, and I also want to thank you for your service.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.